You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, President Francois Hollande's abrupt reinvention of himself as Commander-in-Chief in a renewed war on terror. Is it credible? And more importantly, is it likely to be effective? My guests Daniela Pelled and Roger Boys will be here to discuss that and other developments from France, including France's decision to invoke for the first time ever the EU's Mutual Assistance Clause, obliging other member states to come to their aid. We'll ask what help France can expect and why they didn't ask NATO. Also, Turkey's insistence that they warned France about at least one of Friday night's attackers. Do we expect too much of our intelligence services, and how much more power do they really need? And tonight's football match between England and France at Wembley. Will England fans attempting to sing La Marseillaise really foster solidarity, or have the French suffered enough? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Daniela Pelled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Roger Boys, diplomatic editor at The Times. Welcome both. We will be coming to my guests shortly, but first up, we're going briefly live to Paris, from where we are joined by our correspondent there, Tom Burgess-Watson. Tom, welcome to the show. First of all, over the last few days, how has Francois Hollande's insistence that the country is actually at war gone down with the French press and public?
Well, Hollande made that announcement, France is at war. They were the opening words of his statement to a joint session of the upper and lower houses at Versailles, which was, of course, a very symbolic occasion, because it's only ever happened once before in French history that the two houses have been assembled there at Versailles. I think people do feel very much that the country is at war. It's in fact something the Pope has mentioned too. He's talked for some time about what he's called a piecemeal third world war being waged by the Islamic State organization. So I think people are getting familiar with that kind of language, but still people are extremely shocked. And I think what's perhaps the focus of a lot of the media coverage at the moment is still the human stories, although of course there has been a good deal of political activity and a lot of statements issued by the various authorities here in France.
And what's the mood like being in Paris today? We're coming, I guess, towards, well, we've just passed the end of the second full working day since the attacks on Friday night. Do you sort of sense the mood drifting in any one particular way or the other?
The official period of public mourning comes to an end today. That's the third day. I think people getting back to work, the public transport is slowly filling up again. I mean, yesterday and the day before, the trains were running absolutely empty around Paris. People were quite nervous. But I think people getting back to business, I've just heard anecdotal evidence, someone coming in on the Eurostar, there were 12 people on the train. So, really very nervous out on the streets and the sense that perhaps tourists are keeping away. But you know, life is going on for many Parisians who are returning to work. The construction workers in the building just opposite where I live are all back at work. Everyone seems to be just getting on with things, because as you all know, this is not the first time Paris and the Parisians have been through this this year. It's a sort of sad realization that this is a second major attack on our city, and people just saying there's nothing to be gained from not getting back to work. And really, perhaps that's the best message to send the world, that the country is defiant and the people of Paris are strong and united.
Tom Burgess-Watson in Paris, thank you very much for joining us. We'll come back now to our studio guests, Daniela Pelled and Roger Boys. Now, the attacks we'll be discussing tonight have unsurprisingly had a fairly seismic effect on domestic French politics, most obviously in the transformation of President Francois Hollande. He spent much of his term battling approval ratings lower than those of Louis XVI and a widespread popular image of a vague, hesitant blancmange. We've seen this decisive reinvention as a martial leader. The questions, I guess, are, is it sustainable and will it actually be effective? Roger, I'll ask you first. Do we get a sense of And I think allowing for his quite understandable anger and grief that I'm sure all French people are feeling. But has he seized upon this as his moment of destiny, do you think?
Well, I mean, he's got no choice, really. It's as president, you're not bound by the parliament before taking military action, for example. He's got to make those decisions fast. It's not about consensus. Here it would be about very frantic consensus building in parliament before we made a decision like that. And it would be a good 4 or 5 days of dithering and leaks to the newspapers. Hollande actually reacted very fast and therefore looks decisive, but that's institutional. Yeah. But he has got better. Frankly, he was hopeless at the beginning, and now he has an efficient prime minister and he has an efficient economics minister. That's to say, one that we in the centre-right press agree with, but he's all right. He's got a feel for things. He almost blubbed, which is always quite a good thing to do. And he's quick, and he's got the hardware. Our jaws dropped in the newspaper when they said they sent 12 jets to bomb Raqqa, because we can barely scrape up 12 jets in Britain. I think we've got 8 in Cyprus, and 2 of them are not really working very well. It's just astonishing, and we're actually quite admiring of all this, I think, in Britain. The problem is what comes next. Yeah, that's to say, if he goes deeper into war and the popular mood says, oh my God, no, we don't want anything to do with this, and I think they are quite nervous at the moment, the French people, it could be that the danger is you have a situation which was a bit like Spain in 2004, when you had this multiple attack. It was blamed initially on ETA, and then they realized it's Al-Qaeda. There was a general election, and you got a new government, which then promptly took Spain out of the Iraq war. Well, that's the model for any jihadist, any thinking jihadist out there. That's the model, That's how you interfere in European politics. That's how you change direction. And so that's why Hollande's first reaction has to be, oh my God, no, life's going to go on as it is, except we're going to have a war and we're going to bomb you. Because he wants exactly to say the opposite of what happened after Spain in 2004. But what might happen is the reaction that happened in Spain in 2004. That's to say that people say, well, what the hell are we doing here? Why are we picking a fight? We're just going to make ourselves targets. That's the problem.
Daniela, how much of that swiftness with which he's acted do you think is a domestic political consideration? Is he obliged to act quickly and decisively, not just against France's obvious enemy, the Islamic State, but to, interdict any potential gains by the National Front? They have big regional elections coming up 3 weeks from now. National Front are widely tipped to win at least one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, of course, the second time in quick succession there's been a major attack in Paris. This happened on his watch. The country has been on a high alert for the last 6 months, and it still took place. Certainly, he'll want to. He doesn't have to worry about elections for another 18 months, but certainly he'll want to head off the National Front. I mean, I think it's. I think he's got a hard. I think he's got a hard task ahead, because for all this decisive action, I think it's very plausible that France is not really going to want to put boots on the ground, which is really what we're talking about when it comes to defeating Islamic State, and to have a sustained war. I mean, I'm not quite sure what sort of war he's talking about, really, because if he's talking about defeating Islamic State militarily, is he talking about doing that in a coalition, talking about sending French troops? I mean, the bombings have been very dramatic, as we just said, and I have long been supportive of military action against Islamic State, but it's not enough on its own.
Roger, do you get the sense as well that he is perhaps unusually personally invested in this as well? He was at the Start de France on Friday night when the bombers attacked. He may even have been one of the targets. And I think people have forgotten, among the horror that did unfold, how much worse it could have been. The three suicide bombers at the Start de France actually proved to be fairly ineffectual for one reason or another.
Yes, yes, I suppose he came very close, did he not? So I suppose there is some. I mean, that would explain why he was so obviously emotionally shaken by the event. Most politicians, they kind of transcend that quite fast, I think. They sort of, because they're surrounded by people who are, you know, who are giving them sound bites to say, and all the machine takes over. You know, you're hustled out, you know, you're given things to say, you call your National Security Council together, you do this, you do that, and you don't really have time to think, oh my God, that was a near-run thing. And yet it crept out with him. And he is, you know, we've seen through his various sort of romantic attachments, he has that kind of sensitivity, which I mean, at the beginning of his reign, I think a lot of French men thought of him as a wimp, and now maybe they don't. Is that, I don't know whether that's progress.
I'm not sure he makes
that progress?
Truly convincing, you know, military leader, but he is showing some backbone.
Yeah.
But on that subject, Daniela, and you mentioned this yourself, that he has said France is at war, but he hasn't given us yet, at least, any idea of how he intends to conduct that or what his idea of victory is, other than just saying he's going to destroy Islamic State, which is a long stretch easier said than done. Has he, I guess, overcommitted France, do you think? Is there a worry that he's vowed to do something that France can't actually do by itself?
Well, no, because everyone's vowed to defeat Islamic State. Everyone's declaring war on them left, right and centre. But everyone has a very different idea of what war on them means. I mean, Assad's version of defeating Islamic State is very different from, you know, the Iraqi government, for instance. Perhaps he has overstretched himself because he's reaching out. So I think we're going to discuss this. He's reaching out to Europe, asking for extra help. But fundamentally, it comes down to what is France willing or able to commit itself. I don't think it's, I mean, this is being horribly simplistic, but I don't think it's impossible to defeat Islamic State militarily, but you have to have enough people who have enough state actors who have enough vested in it to want to cooperate and do it, and not only do it, but also do something to fill the vacuum that will create. That seems very implausible right now.
Well, we are going to discuss that very thing right now, because Hollande does appear to have recognised France's limitations, at least to this extent. Today, France became the first nation to invoke the EU's Mutual Assistance Clause. This obliges all 28 member states to provide aid and assistance by all means in their power, whatever that may turn out to mean. Roger, why is France pulling on this one and not the celebrated Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, the all-for-one, one-for-all clause, as it's known?
Well, I think the Americans have told them not to do it. I think that's the simple answer. I think that Article 5 is too crude an instrument for what they want to do. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is that the Russians don't want it. Yeah, and so the Americans are saying, don't do it. It will completely destroy any relationship in Syria with Russia. And so that's the main reason why NATO's off the cards and the Lisbon Treaty is back on. But what can actually be achieved by that is nothing, really. I mean, I think it's just a rhetorical way of saying terrorism is a multinational problem, therefore we have to have a multinational solution. You know, but frankly, we already have a 63-member coalition against, you know, going on there. It's not something that we need to reinvent. So it's quite complex. But if Obama was a slightly different person, I could see that a coalition of the willing could quite quickly be pulled together, in which could indeed involve some kind of ground contingent, even though, again, you know, this week he was very quick, almost as a reflex, said, oh, you know, no ground troops. But actually, there was a little bit of wriggle room in there. I mean, it was a kind of no, not 100,000 ground troops, you know, but maybe a little bit more than 50. So it could be that we end up with some ground ground troop contingent there, in which the French, to which the French could contribute French legionnaires or whatever. They've got some pretty tough guys there who could form some kind of useful component. But it would have to be in training, advising, kind of giving backbone to the Iraqi army for an attack on Mosul, or finding some kind of proper communication links with the Free Syrian Army that would make something possible there. But that's all kind of military stuff that's kind of hovering around and people are arguing about it. And it hinges very much on Obama. All of this whole question of Article 4 or Article 5 of NATO, Lisbon Treaty even, and the Coalition of the Willing, it's all really about Obama's apparent indifference to what's going on.
Daniele, do you think this is a largely symbolic gesture by France? I mean, they will be presumably aware that the EU's record is an item in itself for dealing with crises of this nature, especially ones which may necessitate a military response, is not terrific. One thinks back 20 years to the absolute shambles they made of Bosnia.
Yeah, that's said with great understatement. I think it's an emotional request. It's an emotional response. I can't see anything practical coming out of it. Europe is really being tested to its limits right now with the refugee crisis, and some of the requests that Hollande has made in terms of border controls, intelligence, and so on, are also pushing Schengen, which is already looking pretty tatty. So I think this is saying, look, European fellow partners in the European project, will you help us? And people have made noises saying yes, we will possibly, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Final brief thought on this one from you, Roger, before we move on. We've seen Russia today, upon acknowledgement that flight was indeed brought down by an Islamic State bomb over the Sinai, has launched cruise missiles at Islamic State targets, or so they claim. Bearing in mind what you said, and I think it's quite plausible that the reason Article 5 is not being discussed is to keep Russia on side. Is it possible that Russia could end up being a more useful ally to France here than the rest of the EU?
Well, it depends what Russia is going to do with those cruise missiles. If it's going to wipe out people who we need to be sitting around a round table to form a transitional government to oust Assad, then he's not, you know. But today's targets were indeed, as far as I could see, ISIS. I think that's true. And they were, seem to be in the Raqqa area, I think they were landing.
We are, of course, taking Russia's word for that.
We're taking Russia's word for it. And we're also taking, and maybe the Russian cruise missiles don't have the, the pinpoint accuracy of Western cruise missiles. So who knows, you know, how many wedding parties or something may have been wiped out in this particular attack. I'm a bit of a skeptic about Russia's contribution in general in all of this.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellet and Roger Boyce. Coming up next, should France have seen it coming? Turkey seems to think so.
Magic and realism are constant themes in Miami. Our new Monocle Travel Guide to Miami explores this alchemy and shares the knowledge we've acquired from our regular pilgrimages down south.
There is a ridiculous amount of choice when it comes to hotels. The best options are on Miami Beach, often Art Deco gems with retro swimming pools and private beaches. This is Miami, so expect a few little flashy details that you might not get in other US cities. And take advantage of them. That's what you're here for, isn't it?
Nowhere in the US feels quite like Miami. Take a peek by watching our Miami Travel Guide film, now showing on Monocle.com.
A And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Daniela Pellet and Roger Boyce. Now, following January's massacre at the Paris offices of Charlie Hebdo and a simultaneous attack on a Jewish supermarket, France introduced a panoply of new surveillance powers and monitoring of extremist speech, none of which obviously prevented Friday night's horrors. It's axiomatic that we end up knowing more about the failures of intelligence services than their successes, but Turkey, for one, seems to suggest that this one was avoidable. Ankara claims to have twice tipped off France about one of the attackers, Ismail Omar Mostafi. Daniela, is there much point in Turkey saying, I told you so now?
Well, it's not just Turkey, it's Iraq as well.
Indeed, so. And Israel too.
And Israel.
I mean, I think that's traditional at these points. Everyone tries to score some cheap points. And I think certainly the Iraqi claim is a little bit sort of chin rub. They're saying, yes, we knew something was going to happen. We didn't know where, when, who, what, or anything, but we did know. So I would treat that with scepticism. But the problem is that there does seem to have been an intelligence failure, that none of this chatter was picked up, none of this traffic, that this was, that looks very bad for the French right now.
There has been some suggestion that the French intelligence services did anticipate an attack, but thought it would occur during or just after the climate change summit in Paris later this month. I mean, Roger, doubtless there will be reviews and investigations into this, but especially given what we've learnt over the last couple of years about the reach of surveillance that intelligence services have, it does seem extraordinary that a plot of this magnitude could have been assembled without anybody noticing, doesn't it?
Well, first of all, I think their surveillance state doesn't have the extensive... They're not part of the Five Eyes arrangement. US, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, somebody else, Canada. They're not part of that group, so they don't share all the intelligence that we get. But they do, of course, have their own surveillance operations, but they're all run by the external service, or at least this kind of operation. And there's been some structural problem between the two French services, between their equivalent of MI5 and their equivalent of MI6. There's not enough intelligence percolating through to the police levels for all sorts of institutional reasons. And we had that problem too, but we got it sorted out after 7/7. So after about 10 years of work on it, really. That was the MI6 chief, John Saws, who's now retired. That was one of his main contributions to intelligence gathering, that basically to make it more porous. So there is a structural problem, I think. And they're not getting everything. They're not getting everything that we get. So there is also a discussion, and the Germans, for example, have wanted to be part of this Five Eyes thing for a long time, and I think the French do too. But the other thing is, I think that it's actually quite complex with these Mumbai-style attacks. You can penetrate a group, and you can through intercepts or whatever. It depends how they're encrypting their different messages. But to establish links between three separate groups, especially when one of them may well have been plotting in Belgium rather than France, is quite complicated. It's quite a sophisticated bit of tracking. It's not for me to, you know, stand up and defend Inspector Clouseau here, but I do think it was quite tricky, and I'm not so sure that we would have spotted it either.
Daniela, how big a problem is it, as Roger suggested, you have a plot taking part partly in Belgium to be enacted in France, that European intelligence services do still think of themselves as national entities, whereas they're having to track terrorists who are roaming over a borderless continent?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of the problem. What I was reading today about the lack of apparent intelligence sharing between the French and the Belgians, which is quite fundamental. There should have been that those links, you think, would have been made. But also, I think, I don't think people weren't looking for this. I think we have been lulled into a slight false sense of security because the Islamic State so far seemed intent on bolstering its legitimacy as a state, you know, holding onto its territory rather than trying to organise spectacular missions abroad. And all kinds of groups have allied themselves with it. But so far, I think before the Sinai attacks, and the Sinai seem to have the strongest links, and there haven't really been very obvious links between, command and control links between Islamic State and actors elsewhere in the world. And this wasn't one of those, does this still count as a lone wolf attack? I mean, it was very, very well coordinated. So I think it's a new kind of operation that I think we weren't prepared for.
Can I just add to that? One of the elements of this is that there's the large number of suicide bombers, which must mean that there's a bomb maker somewhere, or even a bomb factory. That's quite a big task to prepare 8 suicide vests, to prime them and to distribute them. And they obviously weren't smuggled in, except perhaps from Belgium into France, but they certainly weren't smuggled from anywhere more distant than that. So, and that involves accumulation of chemicals and of triggers and all sorts of things. So there's been, certainly been a failing, and I would bet it's Belgian failing, since they have such a chaotic institutional police force and overlap of forces. There has been a failure on that thing. That's something you can't afford to miss if someone's going around buying stuff for, you know, 8 suicide vests, and quite powerful ones too. So, okay, that's my Tuppence Halfpenny worth on that.
Well, finally tonight, we will try to end on a slightly more upbeat note, because about 90 minutes from now, France's national football team will kick off against England at Wembley Stadium. Now, under normal circumstances, this would not be an occasion distinguished by the fraternal hospitality of the home fans, but as we've been discussing, these are not normal circumstances. Wembley's arch has been lit up as the tricolour, as indeed it has been since Saturday. England's fans will be encouraged to join in on La Marseillaise. Daniela, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, the Duke of Cambridge is going. Jeremy Corbyn, the Leader of the Opposition, is going. Doubtless probably won't be yelling, encouraging anyone to shoot.
Shoot to kill. Yeah.
How much do gestures like this actually matter, do you think?
Well, as you know, Andrew, I have absolutely zero knowledge or understanding of anything involving the sports world, but I do understand that this game is somehow symbolic and very meaningful for a lot of people. And so I think this is a good idea. This is a great idea. I mean, much more moving, I think, and much more meaningful than changing your Facebook profile to the colours of the French flag. And apparently they're also going to project the words of the Marseillaise onto the walls of the stadium or something, which is quite good, because I don't think anyone knows it past the bit where it says Enfants de la Patrie, really. Perhaps not even many French people.
I suspect it's going to be a rendition of France's splendid anthem, in which the good intention is going to have to count for rather a lot. On a more serious note, though, Belgium were due to play a friendly game tonight against Spain in Brussels. They've called that off.
Yeah.
Is this the right thing to do, to go ahead with this one, do you think, Roger?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course it is. Of course, you know. I don't think there's any doubt at all. We have to establish it's not just about being nice to the French.
No, we should definitely win.
Yeah. Well, no. Actually, given England's form, I think we might let the French win this. It's not just about solidarity. I think it's about demonstrating to the British population that we can hold an event like this and be absolutely secure. I mean, and it will be very interesting to see, the security around Wembley. It's going to be multiple layers and levels. I think everyone's been told to get there half an hour early. In fact, I was coming here on the tube. It was full of people already singing the Marseillaise, yeah, and in this kind of franglais, this kind of mangling it, really, killing the national anthem. So that's it. I think it's a demonstration that we haven't lost our sense of security in London either.
Well, let's hope not. Roger Boyce and Daniela Pellard, we will have to leave it there. Thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, you can hear Sophie Grove with tracks from Monocle's international playlist. Josh Fennett follows with Section D at 1900. The Monocle Daily is at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 London time, but for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.